You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Returning to the show this week is author Mark Elliott. Mark Elliott is a chronicler of American popular culture and the author of many fine books. He's written about rock and roll in biographies of the Eagles, Bruce Springsteen, and others, including his classic biography of Phil Oakes. His biographies of Hollywood personalities comprise a jigsaw puzzle history of the American cinema, from his books on Walt Disney, John Wayne, Ronald Reagan, Clint Eastwood, Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, Steve McQueen, and Jack Nicholson, to his latest, Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon. Mark Elliott, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Good to be back.
You know, I think the most surprising thing for me in your new book, Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon, is how much you seem to really admire Heston as an actor and a person.
Well, he's an admirable guy. I mean, he did a lot of good things in his life, and a lot of things that people don't know about. So one of the purposes of this book was to try to bring a little bit, shed a little bit of light on the other side of his life. Everybody knows about the NRA and all that. But that tends to overshadow the rest of his work. And, you know, I always try to write about rebels. That's kind of a theme, if you could trace through, I guess, through my work, if I were criticizing myself, which I'm not. But I like people who are a little bit off the mark, off the bullseye, super talented, but maybe just a little bit off. And going all the way back to Phil Oakes and Springsteen and Paul Simon and Cary Grant, all the way through, these are people who are interesting to me because they're not traditionally classic front and center heroes. And Heston really fits that bill. He was the war hero that people really don't know about. He was stationed in the Aleutians in World War II, and he was a radar guy, so a radio man, so he flew on all these missions against the Japanese. And I always find that admirable because I think those guys, those heroes, never talk about it. Most people don't even know he was in the Air Force, or rather in the Army, flying on missions. And then he was a stage actor, primarily. He grew up in the backwoods of Michigan, and somehow found his way to New York City with his wife, which his wife was the first girl he ever really talked to in when they were both going to Northwestern. So they were both in the theater, wanted to be actors, came to New York, and lived in a fourth-floor walk-up with no heat, no bathroom, and lived that young bohemian life. So I kind of enjoy that because I did that too earlier in my life. I wasn't married, but I lived in Greenwich Village and then later on in Hell's Kitchen. And so I can identify with that. And I think everybody can because he went from there to the heights of Hollywood. And that to me is a great story.
Well, the careers of John Wayne and Ronald Reagan, who I read about in your books, they both benefited from the advent of World War II. That kind of opened the doors for them as performers because they stepped into a vacuum that was left when all the stars went to war.
That's right.
And I guess you could say by the same token that Charlton Heston's career was helped along by the Blacklist.
It was helped along. He was a little too young to be involved in all of that. He made his first film in 1951, Dark City, out in Hollywood. It was a small film for Paramount, but he didn't have the name or the power to really, have any influence on the Blacklist, and B, to have been noticed by HUAC. He wasn't that big. He wasn't that important. So he kind of slid by. And I'll tell you something else about the Blacklist that's fascinating to me. No big stars were really on the list. It was all the middle people, middle writers, middle directors, middle actors, and Hollywood was not about to commit total suicide, nor was HUAC about to put Hollywood out of existence. So they really went after the middle people and left the very big and the very small alone. And Heston was really one of the very small.
But what I'm thinking of specifically is the High Noon was a far greater film than The Greatest Show on Earth and probably should have won Best Picture. But there was like a campaign against it, which propelled The Greatest Show on Earth to the Best Picture Oscar, which really helped make Heston a star.
Well, no question that High Noon is the better picture. I don't think anybody in his or her right mind would think that The Greatest Show on Earth was not only not greater than High Noon, but not that great a movie. I mean, the origins of the film are very interesting. I won't go into it now, but it was a film that DeMille inherited from Daryl Zanuck, who had the rights to it and then let it go because he couldn't make a deal with the circus people. But Heston, in that film, plays DeMille. In the film, he's the leader of the circus, and DeMille is the director of the film. So he was looking for somebody to be his on-screen other. And while DeMille was kind of small, bald, a little bit homely, here's Heston, tall, grand-looking, sophisticated Midwest, and that's who DeMille saw as, oh, that's me. I could put him on the screen. You know, a little bit like Hitchcock and Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart. I mean, it's the same kind of idea that, well, that's who I really am. I just look this way, but that's who I really am. The way that Heston got that film was after Dark City failed. It was a film noir in which Heston played the bad guy, and it's something that he was not good at, and an audience never could buy him as a bad guy, and eventually found his right place as a good guy, as Moses and Ben-Hur. But in that film, when it flopped, he was ready to go back to New York. His wife was still in New York. He missed her. He wanted to go back to live TV, and he wanted to go back to live TV, but DeMille saw him on the studio grounds at Paramount, and Heston, because he was Heston, saw him there and waved to him. And DeMille said to his assistant, "Who is that guy? Who's waving at?" And his assistant said, "Oh, that's Chuck Heston. He was just in that film noir that you didn't like." And DeMille said, "Well, I like him now. I like the way he waved at me. Let's screen test him." So, I mean, the point of all that is that Heston had no say in any of that film. He was just an actor and not a well-known actor. So the fact that politically the High Noon was a film that HUAC was able to pressure the Academy into not giving an award means really that DeMille, who was very friendly to the blacklist and one of the real agitators on that side of the spectrum, it was kind of a gift to him. But beyond all that, by the time it opened, the film was the number one box office film that year. So people loved it. And it actually made a lot more money than High Noon made. And to the Academy, that means something. That, you know, the Academy loves successful films. When you watch the awards, they almost never give these awards to films that haven't made any money. That's really just not the way the Academy Award, the Academy operates, and it's not a very good measure of whether a film is good or not. It's just something that the Academy uses as a way to sell movies. That's really what the Oscars are all about. They're a sales gimmick. So to say that The Greatest Show on Earth won over High Noon, yes, agreed. And was it political? Probably. But of the two films, The Greatest Show on Earth was more popular at the time, and Heston really was just a player. He had no influence, and it didn't win because of him. He wasn't well known enough.
It's interesting, just as kind of a side note, about how the films that won the Academy Awards in the past were also the films that were commercially successful, whereas now the movies that are most commercially successful never get nominated for any awards and never get any awards. You know, movies like, you know, Iron Man 3 and whatever.
I think a couple of years ago, the ones based on the trilogy won.
The Lord of the Rings.
And Lord of the Rings. But that's unusual. Even the Titanic, I think it won Best Director, but I'm not sure if it won Best Film that year.
It did, yeah.
It did. But that's kind of an unusual circumstance, because that film had all the parts coming together. It had DiCaprio. It had the actress who was very popular.
Kate Winslet.
That's right, Kate Winslet. And it was spectacle. It was spectacle done well. But usually, you know, films today are made. The big films are pitched at 17-year-old kids, 18-year-old kids. They're just like they always were. They would date movies. I mean, it's like when you listen to music today, pop music, contemporary music, it's all pitched to kids. And so when you get out of that record buying range or CD range or download range, there is not that much music for you. And there's not that many movies that are made, because they can't make their money back. So you look at the 50s, you look at the time of Heston. Those were so-called adult films, because adults in those days went to the movies. And The Greatest Show on Earth, I would suggest people take another look at it. It's not that bad.
I think it really holds up quite well. I mean, I remember at one time thinking, you know, that it was maybe one of the worst movies to ever win Best Picture. But now I think there are many, many worse films that have won Best Picture since then.
Absolutely.
And Jimmy Stewart's in it. Yeah, Jimmy Stewart. I mean, it's kind of corny, but on the other hand, especially now that Ringling Brothers is going out of business,
it's
a real piece of history to see the circus.
You know, the reason why Zanuck didn't make the movie, he had all the rights to everything. He couldn't make a deal with the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And his studio, Fox, was not willing to put up that money. When the rights lapsed, DeMille grabbed them, because to him, movies were a circus. They were a spectacle. And it was easy for him to create a story around a group of traveling stage performers. And, you know, in all the melodrama, the fella falling off the high wire and the women in love with the wrong guy, all that is perfect DeMille. I mean, his films from the silent era right up to the 50s, right through The Ten Commandments, which is his last film, are all based on spectacle. That was his thing. So he was a movie maker. He wasn't an introverted thinking director like a Hitchcock or a Wyler. You know, Wyler, when he made Ben-Hur, he said that... And Ben-Hur, which basically was a remake of The Ten Commandments, which we can talk about if you want, he said, my film is better than DeMille's film because it takes a Jew to make a movie about Jesus. And, you know, I mean, there's some truth to that. What Wyler was really saying was that he was an intimate filmmaker. That's what he really meant, is that his films were personal and intimate, whereas DeMille's films were impersonal and spectacular. Even the Ten Commandments, I mean, if you ask people what they remember about the film, they'll tell you the parting of the Red Sea and the burning bush. But when you ask them about Ben-Hur, what they remember, they will say to you, Jesus giving water to Ben-Hur. And that's a very personal moment. And you really haven't got too much of that in the Ten Commandments. But in the Ten Commandments, you have something else. You have the fingerprints of DeMille, and that makes that film extraordinary, and Heston's amazing performance in it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're chatting this week with biographer Mark Elliott, whose latest book is Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon. Let's talk about Heston as an actor. I mean, you say in the book, and hey, by the way, people, we're talking with Mark Elliott, one of my favorite biographers, and his new book is called Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon. The kind of actor that Heston was, I mean, he wasn't a method actor a la Brando, but at the same time, he seems kind of like a method actor, the way he gets into character and wears his costume home.
Well, you know, Brando was from the Stella Adler School and Stanislavski, and that whole way, that whole method is based on finding something inside of you that emotionally matches the emotion that you discover in the scene. So, what do I mean by that? Brando in Streetcar, playing Stanley Kowalski, found all of that inside of himself and used that to create, you know, the Bear Man, the Kowalski that is the character in Williams' play. But in Heston didn't have that much interior turmoil. You know, he was a country kid. He was from the woods, and what he did was he drew upon external forces. He used things like the costume, the surroundings, things that really could give him the physical feel of a character. And he always, that's how he approached his acting. When he was at Northwestern and studied acting, he couldn't get into the method. You know, all these 16 and 17-year-old kids trying to find these emotional matches in their life, they didn't live that much. They didn't have any experience. So the method was kind of a tortured, look at me, I'm a method actor, I'm Marlon Brando, or Monte Clift, or Jimmy Dean. I mean, those were people, they were able to do that. Most actors can't do it. And Heston was smart enough, I think, to realize that wasn't going to work for him. So when he was in the Ten Commandments, he wore all this makeup and all these costumes, and he wore them all day. Went home wearing those costumes and would wake up and put them on. And that led him to his character. And I think it worked. I think when you see him in the Ten Commandments, it may be a little corny to people. It may be a little old-fashioned. But it's a profoundly riveting film, and he is great in it. I think he's wonderful in that film.
It's still a perennial that they show, you know, every Easter on TV.
And when that's right. And when kids find it and see it for the first time, I know I saw it for the first time when I was 10 years old, and I had no idea what the burning bush was, and I didn't know why the sea could part like that. But it was still riveting. It was still something that it can still hold your attention, even with all the commercials and all that. It will keep you there because it's a special movie. And I think people should take another look at that film. It's worth it. Not just him, but Edward G. Robinson and all the women in the film, Yvonne DiCarlo, they are spectacular. And DeMille, you know, that was his zone. He knew how to do that.
But Ben-Hur is a very different kind of picture, although it seems like more of the same, but it's not.
Well, yes and no. You know, MGM, which made Ben-Hur, was going broke. They were practically bankrupt. And it wasn't just MGM. It was all the majors were struggling. Part of it was the blacklist that had decimated their writers, their directors. Part of it was television that had taken a lot of the audience away from the movie-going habit. And a part of it were some Supreme Court decisions that made the studios give up their movie theaters, which really hurt them because they would make films, distribute them, and exhibit them and knew what they were going to make. That was the old movie-going habit. When that was destroyed, they really lost their bank. So by the time MGM in the late 50s, they were practically broke. They had put all their money into Raintree County in 1957 with Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor, hoping that would be another Gone with the Wind. Southern, you know, Gothic. It had all the elements, but Clift was drinking heavily. He had that accident. Taylor was having marital problems and on a big diva trip. So that film not only didn't make any money, but almost put MGM out of business. So they got together at the studio and they said, we have to make a film that we know can make money. What's made money recently? And everybody said, well, The Ten Commandments is the biggest grossing film of the 50s. So the top two films in 1956, by the end of 56, were Greatest Show on Earth and The Ten Commandments, both Heston films and both DeMille films. So they constructed Ben-Hur to be a kind of a copy of The Ten Commandments. And if you think about it, it's not that difficult to see. In both films, the young Jewish hero starts off as a prince and then becomes a slave, both of them, and then becomes a prince again, has to go up against a rival. Well, in The Ten Commandments, the rival is Yul Brynner, the prince, the pharaoh. And in Ben-Hur, it's Messala, the fellow, his childhood friend, who grows up, and they become enemies. He's the Roman signatory. So it's very similar. Both in love with the same woman in Ben-Hur. Same thing in The Ten Commandments. Ben-Hur, you have the chariot race. In The Ten Commandments, you have the parting of the Red Sea. So they really constructed that film to be fail-proof. And then the cherry on top of the ice cream was getting the same actor who played Moses to play Ben-Hur, which was Charlton Heston. And, of course, that's the film he won his Academy Award for Best Actor, and saved MGM. So that's a good story. Writing about Ben-Hur was fascinating to me because of the amount of time and the difficulty they had making that film. You see it today, it's great if you can see it on a big screen anywhere, because that's a film where every inch of the screen is just beautifully rendered, and a William Wyler film. So there is, as I said before, there's kind of an interior personality to the film that a lot of Heston's films don't have. So, and of course, it was the biggest grossing film of the 50s, 1959, and really the end of the studio era. When Ben-Hur opens, runs for a year, and closes, that's it, really. The studios are then one by one sold off, and the system comes to an end. So that film is a benchmark for a lot of reasons. Really, I think, an important film and a very good film.
So, Mark Elliott, your book about Charlton Heston, Hollywood's last icon, it really kind of straddles the two eras of the golden age of Hollywood and the new golden age of Hollywood, the new Hollywood era.
That's right. And he had, you know, he struggled after Ben-Hur. He made a film called El Cid, which was probably not the best choice, because it was about an African-based Muslim invasion of Spain. I don't think anybody in America even heard of Muslim armies. I don't think in those days, unlike today, that was something nobody had any interest in. It was made with foreign money. It was shot in Spain, and it was a hit overseas, but it kind of put the brakes on Heston's spectacular rise. And then there were other films that he made in the 60s that he really loved. His favorite film, he always said, of his entire career was Will Penny, a Western that resembles Shane. It's very similar to Shane in a lot of ways. And it appealed to Heston because he was never a romantic lead. And I think that, if anything, was his big failing as an actor. He wasn't a Gregory Peck. He certainly wasn't a Cary Grant. He wasn't even a Jimmy Stewart. But he was Charlton Heston. So what he could do, they couldn't do. I think he once said, maybe I can't be a romantic lead for Alfred Hitchcock, but I don't think Cary Grant could play Moses. And I something to that. You know, there's some kind of logic there. I think that works.
Will Penny really has that feeling of the 1970s independent film kind of Western.
And it's really, it's a film about the end of the Westerns. So it's an end of the Western film about the end of the Westerns. And I think he was aware of that. And the character he plays is somebody he was very close to. He was raised in the woods. This character is a real backwoods guy. He was reticent toward women. Will Penny, certainly reticent toward women. There was a boy in the film who he, the son of the girl, the woman he falls in love with, who's a widow. He and his father were very close when he was a boy until his parents got divorced. So he understood this character, and he understood what Will Penny meant to the woman and to the boy. And that was a wheelhouse that Heston could move in very, very easily. That's a good film. I recommend it if people haven't seen it. And also, it will show you that Heston was more of an actor than just chariots and partings of seas. I mean, this is a film with no special effects. Most of it takes place in a cabin, and he pulls it off.
Well, he had a whole nother wheelhouse coming his way that nobody knew was coming with this movie, Monkey Planet. Who thought Monkey Planet would be a good movie?
Monkey Planet was a film made at a time when science fiction had practically disappeared from the screen. And the reason was because, except with a few exceptions, like War of the Worlds and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, most science fiction films in the 50s were B-movies. They were kind of the second film on the show. Sometimes they only showed them at matinees for kids. And they all had that foreign professor in them who warned, you know, unless mankind stops setting off nuclear bombs and you'll get these creatures coming out of the ocean. They were kind of, you know, silly pseudo-message films. But when Heston got the script for Monkey Planet, which became Planet of the Apes, he wisely sent the script over to Rod Serling of Twilight Zone fame, and he let Serling rewrite it. And when you see Planet of the Apes, if you're a Twilight Zone fan, it looks like several Twilight Zone episodes all rolled into one. You know, there was a Twilight episode where a spaceship crashes and on another planet, and the three spacemen eventually starve to death or can't get any water and die. And then the camera pulls back, and a mile away is the 405 highway in California. So that kind of stuff. I mean, that's vintage Serling. And also, that's very much what Planet of the Apes is, because the final scene in Planet of the Apes is the Statue of Liberty, which tells you and tells him, Taylor, I think is his name, is that they're on Earth. They've been on Earth all the time. So Serling put his touch on the script, and when it opened, it not only resurrected Heston's career and brought him right back to the top, it also brought back science fiction. And what people don't always remember is that Kubrick's 2001 opened almost 6 months after Planet of the Apes and got all the credit for, wow, look at these apes, look how realistic all this is, and what a great science fiction film. I'm not saying that Planet of the Apes is a better film, but it really brought about a renaissance of science fiction, as did Kubrick. But you have to give Heston a lot of credit, because he found that script and he wanted to make it. And a lot of people said, oh, you're going to run around in a loincloth, that'll put the final nail in the coffin of your career. No, no, he said, this film can work. And he was right. And it not only did it work, but they're still making Planet of the Apes films. That's a franchise that still lives on. So, you know, he knew what he was doing. And then, of course, Soylent Green and Omega Man, these were all films that come out of that renaissance of sci-fi that he was kind of responsible for.
Well, you know, I love 2001, but at least when you watch The Planet of the Apes, you know exactly what's going on in the story, whereas I defy anybody to tell me what happened in 2001.
I mean, 2001 is about everything, and you can't figure out any of it. In Planet of the Apes, it's about nothing, and yet it's incredibly entertaining because it's about nothing. I mean, it's pure entertainment, and the girl in the film, I remember her name, Linda Harrison, who then married Daryl Zanuck, who was the producer of the film. I mean, her little Hollywood trivia there. And she was perfect in this film. She had no dialogue, which Heston later said was probably the best thing for her and the film. And he and she, ran around, well, you know, with no clothes on for 2 hours, and audiences loved it. You know, it had a little bit of everything, a little sex, a little sci-fi, everything but rock and roll. The only thing it didn't have.
It had a lot of comedy, and you know, you don't think of Heston as being really good with comedy, but there's some funny bits in that movie.
Very funny stuff, and he was very funny stuff, and he was into it. He got it. He knew it was funny. He knew he wasn't doing Shakespeare, and he loved that. You know, when he was in New York City struggling, when he and his wife were living in Hell's Kitchen, to make money to pay the rent, he posed nude for the Students Art League up on 57th in Manhattan, not that very far from where he lived. And his wife made him a little jockstrap, a little colorful jockstrap to wear, which he did to cover himself up. But that shows you that they were not as uptight as people think they were. You know, they had a good laugh over it. They shared the fun of it. And then she did some... His wife did some catalog modeling, some lingerie and all that. So they were, you know, they were young, cool kids from the Midwest in New York City and loving it. And you see some of that in Planet of the Apes, where he has no self-consciousness. You know, he's not at all ill at ease about running around, I guess Malibu is where they shot those beach scenes. You know, in his loincloth. So, I mean, it's a fun film.
I don't think that the next wheelhouse of Heston, the disaster picture, helped his image or his career, I think, with people of my generation. They remember him from those movies, and those were not very good.
Well, they may not have been very good, but again, he brought back a genre that had been kind of killed off. I think John Wayne had done The High and the Mighty, which, talk about films not supposed to win the Academy Award. I mean, that's the king of them. You know, the plane lands, and it looks like a cross on the runway, all of that stuff, and nobody can fly it, and they miraculously live. I mean, that's a genre that had more or less run its course. But when Heston did, I guess it was Skyjacked, I mean, that film made an enormous amount of money, and really put him, again, a decade later, back on the top of the Hollywood A-list. A lot of films that followed weren't as good, but Skyjacked, you know, I'm not saying it's Macbeth, I'm not saying it's Hamlet, but it was an entertaining film and created that that using stars in cameos to fill up an airplane. I mean, that, you know, he never said that this was great acting, but at the time when it came along, it, again, it was a huge success. And I have to give him some credit for that. I mean, the bottom line is this. Most films are not very good. Most films are junk. If you go to the movies or you open up what's playing today, you're not going to say, oh, I've got to go run and see this film. Most films made aren't very good. It's the ones that are good, that we remember, the ones that stay with us or turn a page. And Heston made a lot of those. He Skyjacked, you know, it is what it is. But so many of those films that were made that tried to be that film tried and failed. So, yeah, not a great film, but actually helped his career and gave him his fourth decade of active filmmaking in Hollywood.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're chatting with Mark Elliott, whose latest book is a biography of Charlton Heston. Well, in your book, Mark Elliott, about Charlton Heston, Hollywood's last icon, I was really impressed with the way Heston said no so often to the door of politics, which was continuously opened to him. And he basically said that he didn't want to do it because he was an actor and he wanted to keep acting and he didn't want to give up acting.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you look at Reagan, who actually mentored Heston into the Screen Actors Guild and set him on a more politically minded path, Reagan was a politician who was also an actor. Heston was an actor who was also a politician. When Reagan got the chance to run for governor, he jumped at it. But also, his career was finished as a Hollywood actor. There was nothing left for him to do in Hollywood. So when he had the chance to, I guess, first president of Berkeley, and that led to running for governor, he didn't think twice about it. I mean, that was perfect for him. For Heston, he used to joke around when they would ask him to run for the Senate, which is what they did every 2 years. He would say, "Oh, you know, I'd like to, but I can't afford the salary cut." And that was kind of his way of saying to them, "I'm an actor. That's what I wanted to do my whole life. That's what I am doing, and that's what I'll continue to do." So you kind of have to give him credit for not following that carrot and going down a path that probably would have not led to any place good for him.
So it's kind of unfortunate that he then became associated with the National Rifle Association.
Well, it's unfortunate, yes, and the NRA probably took some advantage of him. But Heston was a Second Amendment believer. You know, that's what he was, a constitutionalist. And after the war, after World War II, he believed that the American soldiers were fighting for something. So whether or not we agree or not with the NRA, and in the book, I try to just present that part of it and let the reader make his or her own mind up. Yeah, I mean, you see it for what it is. He wasn't acting, couldn't get jobs. There was a period in his life where he went for 11 years without making a Hollywood movie. And that's a long time for an actor, too. I mean, actors don't make a movie for 11 weeks and they go crazy. So he had an 11-year span, and part of it was because of his association with the NRA. Producers felt that, you know, it was a kind of a reverse blacklist because he was too far to the right on that issue that audiences wouldn't come to see him. So it was the children of the blacklist who were on the right and vilified the left. Those are the ones who then vilified the right. Not just Heston, but really throughout Hollywood, there was that that kind of informal gray list, and he fell victim to it. But the one thing about him, I will say, that he never regretted what he did. Right or wrong, right move, not such a great move, cost him much of his later career. He never regretted it. He was somebody who felt that if you do something and you believe in it and you pay a penalty, then you pay the penalty. That's the price of your own freedom of choice. And that's how he felt. He never complained to anybody about what he went through. Even Michael Moore, who is a good filmmaker and politically on the left and all of that, you know, when he did that interview by going up to the house, first enrolling in the NRA so he could have credentials, and walking up to the house and kind of trapping Heston. What did Heston do? He got up and he walked away with dignity. He didn't say, "Oh, you dirty rat, I'm going to kill you, how dare you, or you're taking advantage of me." No, he got up and he walked away, leaving Moore with kind of some egg on his face for the way he handled that situation. So, you know, I'm not, I don't take a political position in the book because it's not my politics that are interesting for this, these readers, it's Heston's. And what I want to do is to show what happened and give all the real details, you know, about the hands over you know, my cold dead hands and all of that, which wasn't spontaneous, which wasn't original, which was something he thought would be a good dramatic moment. And he, you know, he paid the price because in our country, the idea that we have freedom of speech really means as long as we're agreeing with everybody. When you disagree and you're unpopular, sometimes you pay a price for that. And that basically is what happened to him. Was it a wise career move? Absolutely not. No way you can say that that's a good career move. But it's something he believed in. And I, that's the story that I tell in this book, is who he was and what he did, without trying to make any political judgments. I think the best way to tell biography is to lay it out and let people make their own minds up. As long as you have accurate information, and my sourcing, as you know, in this book was the best, and as long as you tell what happened. And so people can read it. You know, some people have read it and said to me, "Wow, what a great thing he did." And other people say, "How could he have done such a terrible thing?" So that's, you know, that's the nature of the eye of the beholder. And I think good biography gives a very clear vista for the eye of the beholder. And that's what I tried to do in this book.
Well, you know, the one certain thing about any book by Mark Elliott is that someone is going to be pissed off.
That's right. That's my trademark. I mean, if I can annoy somebody, then that's my total trademark. And also to not hold anything back. You know, I kind of put it out there the way I see it and the way it was. I mean, even with the Jimmy Stewart book, I mean, a book that I thought, wow, everybody will finally love Mark Elliott books because how could you not love Jimmy Stewart? There were people who said, how could you say this and how could you say that? But, you know, when you have a little bit of a reputation and success, if you're going to play in the big leagues, you've got to take an inside pitch. You know what I mean? You have to be able to stand at the plate and take what they throw at you. That's never bothered me. I kind of sometimes enjoy the reactions. But, you know, my goal is to show you what happened and to explain to you who this guy is. And I think at the end of this book, at the end of this big book, you know who he was. Whether you like him more or like him less, you know who he was. And that's what I wanted to accomplish.
Well, you definitely bring him to life on the page, and for me. But the book, it's called Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon. So is this your last book? You're all done?
No, as a matter of fact, no. You know, I like writing. I'm one of those writers. I like writing, and I love going to the movies. I don't know what I would do if I wasn't writing. I certainly get in trouble, that's for sure. So it's, to me, it's not, you don't go to the movies to escape. You go to the movies to find yourself. And with writing, I don't do it because, I've got to get up today. Oh, no, I hope there's something happens where I don't have to write. Just the opposite. If I get up and I go to my desk and I start writing, I'm the happiest guy in the world. And I'll do it for, you know, until the very end when they're dragging me away. Oh, just a few more words. Let me do a few more words.
Out of your cold, dead hands, they'll be prying.
That's right. You'll have to take that pencil out of my cold, dead hand. And that'll be the end of my career right there.
Well, the book is called Charlton Heston, Hollywood's last icon and the author, my guest, Mark Elliott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's great. Always my pleasure. I love talking with you, and we'll see you a little further on down the road.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Mark Elliott, his new book, Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.